150 years ago this year, in 1854, a series of events occurred in the Kansas Territory that many historians, including our guest this week, Nicole Etchison, believe presaged the American Civil War, which began 7 years later. Interviewing Professor Etchison is Talking History's Jim Madison, professor of history at Indiana University.
The unsolved question of the 1850s was whether slavery would grow and expand into the new western lands beyond the Mississippi River. Long before Fort Sumter, Americans shed their blood over that issue of slavery expansion, especially in the new territory of Kansas. In fact, the 1850s introduced the nation to the term Bleeding Kansas, and to the prelude there to the violence that would mark the Civil War. A new book with the title Bleeding Kansas, Contested Liberty in the Civil War Era, argues the struggle in Kansas was part of America's larger struggle, not just over slavery, but over conflicting interpretations of liberty for whites and eventually for blacks. The author of the book, Bleeding Kansas, is our guest today, Professor Nicole Etchison of the History Department at the University of Texas, El Paso. We're talking with Professor Etchison from her office on the campus in El Paso. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Let's set the stage for Bleeding Kansas with a brief description of the issues raised in that well-known Kansas-Nebraska Act of 1854, 150 years ago. Most of us learned about it in high school, but remind us what we know.
The most important thing the Kansas-Nebraska Act did was to remove the prohibition on slavery in that northern region of the Louisiana Purchase that later became Kansas, and Congress had put that prohibition there in the 1820 Missouri Compromise. Kansas-Nebraska Act in 1854 removed it and replaced it with this idea of popular sovereignty to let the settlers who were going to go into that region decide whether or not they wanted to have slavery.
So this idea of popular sovereignty is so very important. Just tell us a little more about what it was intended to do.
Stephen Douglas, the Illinois senator who wrote the Kansas-Nebraska Act and came up with the insertion of popular sovereignty into it, said that it was nothing more or less than the basic American principle of democracy at its finest. Let the people decide. He was also trying to solve a slight political problem. He couldn't get Southern senators in Congress to vote to organize a territory that was going to become free and that would possibly enter Congress's free states and vote against them politically. So he did two things at once, resolve that political problem, but do it in such a way as he thought was kind of the grand democratic principle.
This, Nicole, seems very reasonable, very democratic. You're going to let the people of Kansas Territory decide whether they want slavery or not. But it doesn't work. It leads, in a way, to Bleeding Kansas, doesn't it?
Yes, and it didn't work, I think, for two reasons. First of all, the popular sovereignty, it assumed, as we do today, that democracy works flawlessly, that there will be no hanging chads, that everything will go perfectly. And in fact, in the 1850s, there were things that were not quite perfect. People tended to vote even when they didn't live in a territory because they expected they were going to move into it later. That's what the Missourians do. So there comes to be irregularities in the Kansas election. Some people would have said fraud with the Missourians voting when they shouldn't have. And then the second problem that popular sovereignty and certainly Douglas didn't take into account was the issue of whether or not you can resolve an inherently moral problem through the democratic process. Because no matter what the people decide, if some people think what they decided was immoral, they're not going to accept that decision. And people like that turned up in Kansas Territory. John Brown was such a person.
Right, and we want to talk about John Brown, but I think this reflects the subtitle of your book, which is Contested Liberty in the Civil War Era. What do you mean by contested liberty?
Well, the older interpretations of Bleeding Kansas had talked a lot about slavery, but there are no slaves, or very few, 190-some slaves in Kansas Territory. Some had talked about economic issues. And when I started going through the material, I found that both sides, the free state side and the pro-slavery side, were talking a lot about Bleeding Kansas in terms of a threat to their political rights. They felt threatened. The free staters felt threatened because with the election irregularities, they said, we're not getting to make this decision. The elections are being stolen out from under us.
By pro-slavery voters, many from Missouri, is that correct?
Right, right. Okay. By the fact that the Missourians were coming over and voting in large numbers when they didn't actually live at that moment in the territory. And the pro-slavery side increasingly argued that they had a constitutional right to have slaves and that the free staters couldn't take that away from them. They had a right to have slavery in the territory no matter what the free staters wanted.
So both sides saw this in terms of liberty,
yeah,
their liberty.
Their political rights as voters, as citizens, were being threatened by the way events were playing out.
All right, let's go to this moral issue of slavery and think about how the free state position relates to anti-slavery or abolitionism.
Well, not very many of the free staters were genuine abolitionists. The free state migration, a very small portion of it, in 1855, only 4% of the settlers in Kansas are from New England. And New England was the region most likely to send people consciously as part of an anti-slavery crusade. A huge portion, 47% of the settlers in 1855 were from Missouri, and then another third or so were from the Midwest. And the Midwesterners tended to be more interested in just getting a farm. They tended, insofar as they thought about slaves, to not want slavery but not want blacks around either. They mm-hmm. wanted black exclusion from Kansas. But I think that as events went on and as the turmoil increased, more and more of the northern settlers began to make a link between what was happening to them and the slavery issue, and they got radicalized on issues of slavery and race.
And they moved toward the abolitionist, minority abolitionist position then as a consequence. Is that correct?
Yes, and the great example of that is Jim Lane, who was an Indiana Democrat who moved out into the territory, and he had actually voted for the Kansas-Nebraska Act, and it hurt him politically in Indiana. So he comes out to Kansas, and the famous story is that he declared when he first arrived in the territory that he would as soon buy a Negro as a mule, unquote.
Yes.
And then he goes on to become a radical Republican, to recruit black soldiers for the Union Army. So he goes through some kind of transformation.
Okay, how do we get then from this question, this difference between pro-slavery and free state positions in Kansas and Kansas Territory, how do we get from that to bleeding Kansas, to violence?
Well, partly it comes out of the problems with the elections, which caused the free staters who felt they weren't getting to make the choice of popular sovereignty it offered them, so they create their own political process. They create an extra legal government, the so-called Topeka government, which causes the Missourians and the pro-slavery party and their allies to say, well, that's illegal. That's revolutionary. There is a territorial government controlled by the pro-slavery party. So you have these two different governments in Kansas Territory, and they are at odds. And then there are a couple of triggering events. One is the effort of the pro-slavery party to establish law and order, to suppress that extra-legal Topeka movement, which they try to do in the summer of 1856. And then the other kind of wild card is John Brown, the settler who's moved into Kansas Territory, who's a real fire-breathing, genuine abolitionist, who becomes frustrated by the kind of stalemate and decides that they have to use violence to resolve this. And so he goes out in May 1856 and kills some of his neighbors.
Actually murders fellow citizens. Is that correct, John Brown, in the name of abolitionism?
Yes. Some people debate whether Brown didn't actually pull the trigger or hack anyone himself, but he rounded up his sons and a group of followers, and they took five men out in the middle of the night and killed them under his direction. Some people would insist on that distinction. And the territory was in a very tense state at that point, and those kinds of incidents, the Missourians had attacked Lawrence few days earlier, and then there's the murder of the pro-slavery settlers that Brown and his followers carry out, and that just sets everyone running around shooting at each other.
And this violence even reaches the floor of the United States Senate.
Well, yes, we like to think of the Congress as a place of great decorum, but in the 1800s, there were numerous times when congressmen and senators sort of went after each other. So, yeah, there's the famous brawl also in May of 1856 where a South Carolina congressman goes on the floor of the Senate and beats up a Massachusetts senator who had given a speech about Kansas and who had insulted the congressman's uncle, who was a South Carolina senator, in that speech.
And this senator is Senator Sumner, correct?
Senator Sumner is the Massachusetts senator
yes.
who gets beaten up.
And he's really beaten up. I mean, how badly was he beaten?
Well, there's some debate about that.
Oh, is that?
Actually, one of his biographers thought it was more psychosomatic. He stays out of his Senate seat for a long time, and the people of Massachusetts reelect him to it, even though they know he's not physically going to be there, to make a statement that Southerners can't intimidate them. And again, the North saw the attack on Sumner as a free speech issue. He had spoken out and condemned Southerners, and they had physically attacked him for it. So by reelecting him, in a lot of the public statements, the time Sumner is attacked, people are talking about those Southerners are not going to stop us from exercising our right of free speech.
Yes. Let's go back to the free state people in Kansas. And you indicated earlier that they're really not, most of them at the beginning, at least abolitionists, and even some of them are what we might say racist.
Yes.
But that position changes, and with it becomes, you argue, the possibility of liberty for African Americans. Can you tell us how that works?
Yes. In 1855 and 1856, at the beginning of the free state movement, there are several incidents where Missouri blacks run away into Kansas. Summer of 1856, when Jim Lane was leading a guerrilla band in Kansas Territory, a runaway came to them, and Lane said, "We're fighting to free white men, not black men," and returned him. And that was happening. People in Lawrence, the New England settlement, returned slaves in 1855. But then, by the end of the decade, more and more of the Kansas Free Staters are willing to accept runaways, to help people get their liberty, to chase off slave catchers who are coming after them. And then during the Civil War, there's a flood of refugees, runaway Missouri and Arkansas slaves coming into Kansas. And then, of course, that culminates with the Exoduster movement after the Civil War in the 1870s.
And even African-American men in uniform fighting for the North from Kansas during the Civil War, correct?
Yes, Kansas was one of the first states to enlist black soldiers into the Union Army. And who gets the credit for first depends on whether you go with the official War Department records, because the War Department didn't really want them to do that in 1861. But Kansas can lay a claim to having been one of the first.
Yes. We have only a little bit of time, Nicole, and this is a complicated question, but I must ask you, reading your book, Bleeding Kansas, I get the sense that you suggest the Civil War might have been inevitable, that the possibility of compromise, of avoiding violence, was very slim, even non-existent. Is that right?
I guess the way I would put it is that it became harder and harder to avoid the Civil War. But I do think there were choices that were made. Douglas didn't have to introduce the Kansas-Nebraska Act. He didn't have to remove the prohibition on slavery. He reopened a whole question that many people considered closed. So no, without any Kansas-Nebraska Act, the 1850s would have played out very differently. But I do think one thing Bleeding Kansas did was to exacerbate the tensions, to radicalize people all over the country who were following this drama in their newspapers, and make it harder and harder to avoid the Civil War. But I'm not sure I'm willing to go as far as inevitable.
Okay. I didn't want to put words in your mouth. Thank you very much. We've been talking with Nicole Etchison, author of a new book, Bleeding Kansas, Contested Liberty in the Civil War Era, published by the University Press of Kansas. Thank you, Nicole.
Thank you.